Welcome to Hope for the Wild, where we dive into conversations with inspiring individuals working towards a better world. My name is Chris Morgan, and I'm a passionate advocate for the environment. Today, I have the utmost pleasure of speaking with Kate Rawls, eco-adventurer, writer, former university lecturer, and a passionate advocate of her outdoor philosophy, which challenges, inspires, and supports critical thinking about our relationship with natural living ecosystems. Kate recently released her latest book, The Life Cycle, 8,000 Miles in the Andes by Bamboo Bike. The book charts her incredible 8,000-mile journey from Colombia to Cape Horn, all undertaken on her constant companion, Woody, the bicycle made from bamboo. The Life Cycle is both a gripping travel memoir and a call to action on one of the most pressing environmental issues of our time. Kate, thanks for joining me today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kate. So, just for our audience who may not know, just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. When did your passion for biodiversity and the environment first arise?
That's a good question, Chris. I mean, I think I've always had it. I can remember as a kid always trying to escape from my garden into the wild world outside, and B, being an absolute animal magnet. Like, I was always drawn to animals of whatever, slugs, Alsatians, rampaging bulls, it didn't matter. I must have been a nightmare as a kid. But I think that love of animals and my love of being outdoors sort of came together in an increasing awareness eventually of what our impact on the outdoors and on other animals and ecosystems are. And that, it, you know, all comes together into a form of environmentalism that I think I was born with, frankly.
What inspired you then to undertake such an adventure? I mean, you've done things like this before with your carbon cycle, but with this one in particular, you know, what was the inspiration behind such an epic adventure?
Yeah, I mean, I was a university lecturer for a couple of decades off and on, and as I said, sort of passionate about communicating the issues and also inspiring action on them. I didn't just want to teach about them. I wanted to encourage people to do something. And you don't really have a mandate for that in the university system. You know, you're supposed to be looking at the important intellectual details of particular issues, but your job isn't really to generate a generation of eco-warriors. So that started to become sort of frustrating. Like, I didn't just want to analyze the problem, I wanted to act on it. And also, I've always loved riding my bike, and I've always loved being in mountains, which is surprising because I'm not particularly athletic and never have been, but I've always been a mountain lover. And so I started to wonder whether I could bring those two things together. Could I find a way of riding my bike in mountains that would also raise awareness of the issues and then be able to share them to a wider audience than my university audience? And eventually that came together in the idea of Adventure Plus, using adventurous journeys to help raise awareness and inspire action on our most urgent environmental challenges. And the first one, as you've already mentioned, was the carbon cycle, which was Texas to Alaska back in 2006, on a normal bicycle, not a bamboo bicycle. And normal, it was a steel bicycle. And the focus of that journey was climate change in two of the most oil-intensive, oil-hungry countries on Earth. So that was a fascinating journey. And then I came back and turned it into a slideshow and then eventually a book. But I did that by taking unpaid leave from the university, and I just spent 3 months over it. I did a journey in 2014, which was on a sailing ship looking at ocean plastic pollution. And then a bit later down the line, I was sort of thinking, I really want to do something on biodiversity loss. It's not being talked about anywhere near as much. It's every bit as urgent as climate change. I'd seen some evidence to say that it's more dangerous than climate change, or at least as dangerous, which really shocked me. And eventually I decided I was going to leave my university career completely and just take off and do this job. I had been lucky enough to be able to pay off my mortgage, so I borrowed a lot of money and just went. So that was fantastic. So that and that was like the culmination of the Adventure Plus idea. And of course, amazing for me to be able to have a brilliant personal adventure in the mountains, but while also exploring biodiversity loss as an issue and meeting lots of incredible people that were working on it.
we've touched upon it sort of briefly so far, but can you explain why biodiversity is so critical to our planet and to us as human beings?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So, I mean, biodiversity is basically the extraordinary range of other living beings and other living systems that we share the planet with. So it works on a number of levels. It's biodiversity at the species level. So everything from oak trees to ants, from plankton to blue whales, it's the diversity of life on land, on sea, in our fresh rivers. But it's also the genetic diversity within a particular species. So the genetic diversity within a species of blackbird, say, and it's the diversity of habitats and ecosystems. So that extraordinary contrast between the desert ecosystem and the rainforest ecosystem, for example. And biodiversity is all of those things. And all of those different kinds of species and habitats play different functions, and they come together to give us these so-called ecosystem services. Now, I actually really dislike that language because it makes it sound as if nature's there to provide us with services. And of course, it isn't. It provides services for all of life, and it isn't just a service industry either. But the point about ecosystem services is that they are things like fresh air, clean water, fertile soil, pollination, you know, the things that allow us to live. Biodiversity is literally vital. We cannot live without it. And it's vital to all of life on Earth, not just humans, but it's definitely vital to human life on Earth. And then if you contrast that with what's actually happening to biodiversity, so World Wildlife Fund's latest Living Planet report told us that we'd lost 69% of our populations of wild animals since 1970. That's less than my lifetime, 69%. And that's just animals. And the United Nations has said that we are on track to lose 1 million species of plants and animals and insects and so on. So we're looking at an avalanche of species extinction and the crashing of populations of wild living things. And that is life-threatening to all of us. I mean, we can't survive without pollinators. We can't survive without the ecosystems that these living beings provide us. And also, they're not just, as I say, they're not just a service industry. These are also communities of other life forms that are every bit as entitled to be here as we are. So there are really, really strong ethical arguments for trying to arrest this crash in biodiversity, as well as really, really strong pragmatic and self-interested arguments.
Could you share with us some of your, I guess, one or two of the most kind of striking experiences from your journey? Again, 13 months, 8,000 miles, there must be tons, but what's kind of maybe sort of one or two that really kind of have kind of stuck with you ever since?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most striking things I think was I was literally cycling through what I was exploring. So the diversity of ecosystems that I rode through was just incredible, and some landscapes that where I'd never seen anything like it before. So in terms of the contrast, I spent time in rainforests and cloud forests, which, as I'm sure you can imagine, are hot and humid and bursting with life and just really, really green and lush. And I also spent time in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the driest deserts in the world. Sometimes it doesn't appear as if anything lives there. I mean, things do live there in the desert, and that was extraordinary, in fact, to find out about some of the plants that have figured out how they, you know, strategies for living in such a arid, dry environment, and little insects and beetles and all sorts of things scurry about there. But that contrast was extraordinary. And similarly, the contrast between the amazing spiky white peaks of the Sierra Blanca in Peru. I mean, I loved those mountains. And again, absolutely unique habitat and utterly different from, for example, the Paramo grasslands or the Caribbean coast. So I was cycling through all of these really, really different landscapes and experiencing them visually, but also sort of smelling them and feeling them as I cycled through. That I will never forget. And also I'll never forget, I mean, cycling out into the Bolivian salt flats. Wow, I've never seen anything like it. It's like cycling out into this vast white ocean. Only it's patterned with these hexagonal salt crystals, and they're three-dimensional, so you crunch as you cycle over them. And it's just white, and there's just a white horizon in front of you. It was amazing to be there on my own, and especially amazing to be there overnight and watch the sun go down and be there under the incredible Southern Hemisphere stars with absolutely no light pollution.
Could you tell us about any of those, you know, really kind of challenging moments that you faced? I mean, were there any times when you felt like, you know, on top of the cycling as well, you know, were there any times where you felt like this was just too difficult, or, you know, you kind of just wanted to quit while you were ahead? I don't know.
Well, most of the cycling was fabulous. I mean, I think I spent 98% of the journey grinning and just couldn't believe my luck and privilege to be there. I mean, every day somewhere new and different, these amazing, amazing places I was cycling through, amazing people. I was meeting people working with monkeys and people working with spectacle bears and people working with these incredible forests and then these amazing, brave anti-extractivist activists. And most of it was just extraordinary. In terms of the cycling, occasionally there would be times where it just got really, really, really tough. There was a section in Bolivia where I was trying to go and see some pink flamingos on a colored lake. There were 10,000 pink flamingos, and it was absolutely extraordinary. But oh my, the road was awful. It was deep gravel, and it was at altitude, and there was a headwind. And I spent most of the sort of, I think it took me 4 days to cross this park, and I spent most of them pushing, and one day my average speed was 1.6 miles an hour, despite working myself into absolute exhaustion. And there was one point on that particular section where I threw the bike down and just had a good cry that I can't do this any longer. But then what to do? I mean, you pick up the bike and carry on. In terms of the issue side of it, I think there was a moment when I looked at this lead mine in Cerro de Pasco in Peru. It's huge, it's like a mile across, and I don't know how deep it is, and it's really, really gray, and it's ringed by houses, as I say. And I just thought, and I knew about the brain development problem in the young people in the city. I knew about the toxic tailings going into the water by this stage. And I just thought, I've never seen such a visual example of capitalism at its worst. I mean, capitalism has brought us a huge amount of wealth and increased our quality of life. And now it's a broken system. It's insane to be pursuing profit at the expense of water, of biodiversity, of human life, of life itself. And that's what's now happening in many, 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 many cases. And it was such a visceral example of this unconstrained form of capitalist growth economics at its worst, that it literally stopped me in my tracks. And I'm still thinking about it. I'm still thinking, well, okay, how do we react if that's the kind of root of the problem, if you like, that our systems are set up in such a way that we will go to literally any costs to extract wealth from the earth. Doesn't matter whether the cost is young people's brains or young people's health or fresh water or thousands of species. I'm still struggling with that realization that our system has been fantastic, and now it's out of control, and we need really profound changes.
So the journey kind of came to an end at what you called the end of the world. What realizations did you have as you came to that point, and how do you believe we can all play a role in tackling that biodiversity loss?
Yeah, absolutely. The end of the world is a town called Ushuaia, and that is its actual nickname. It's commonly known as the end of the world, and it felt so significant to finally, I didn't know if I was going to make it on time, and I finally got there sort of in this kind of slightly battered, exhausted manner, but I was so exhilarated to have made it. And it was as if sort of all my thinking came together as I kind of beasted down this final few miles against the Patagonian headwinds. And I mean, the main thing is to realize that biodiversity, nature, other species, it's not a luxury. It's not, you know, a nice to have that we can worry about after we've fixed the economy. It's absolutely vital. We cannot live without it. And so that's the number one realization. It's absolutely vital, and we must do everything we can to protect it. And then I think the second big realization is that all of these issues are interconnected, whether we're talking biodiversity loss, climate change, social inequality, exploitation of people, pollution of water. They're all interconnected, and the deep causes are systemic. They're the way we currently meet our needs on the planet as humans, but they're also about the way we think about ourselves in the world. They're about our worldviews, our mindsets, our tendency in industrialized countries to see nature as sort of out there and for us and not that important. So there are some big, big shifts that we can all be making. And it's an adventure, right? These shifts are huge and uncertain and necessary. And if we think of that as an adventure, then I think that casts it in a much more positive, yes, we can all do something about this sort of light. As far as what we can all do, then that really depends on who we are and what our networks are and what our skills are and what we're passionate about. I mean, I really believe in engaging in these issues in a way that makes us feel alive rather than sort of bound down out of a sense of duty. So find a way of engaging this that makes you feel alive, that makes you feel passionate. And above all, kind of, we all need to learn about what's going on. We need to get past these sort of barriers that you were mentioning earlier and find out more. What is happening to biodiversity? What is happening to the people that are trying to stand up about it? How does that connect with my life? Like, the things I buy have a footprint all over the world. How can I sort of learn more about that and stop being involved with the bad footprints? And then what are the positive things I can do? Whether that's everything from growing wildlife friendly seeds in my garden to buying better products, to supporting organic farming, to campaigning for alternative economic systems. There's just tons and tons and tons of different ways of engaging with these issues as consumers, but also as citizens. I mean, we have an election coming up. How many of us have made the time to contact our MPs and say, "Oi, what are you doing for nature and the climate? Because it's really, really important." That apparently makes a real difference. So there's lots we can do as consumers, but also as citizens, as communicators, and as catalysts. None of us can do this on our own, but working with the people around us, the communities around us, is definitely the way forward.
Fantastic.
And there's a lot of reason for hope. I mean, one of the things I learned is that nature bounces back a lot faster than we thought if we give it a chance. So it's not game over yet. We're getting close, but if we give nature a chance, she'll come back much, much quicker than we think. And people are actually amazing. Our systems are pretty dark at the minute, but individuals are amazing. We can all do more than we think.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So what's next then for yourself and Woody? Any future adventures planned, or is he enjoying retirement?
No, Woody comes to, I've been on the road giving lots and lots of talks. So as you mentioned, I wrote a book, and incidentally, writing the book was much harder than doing the bike ride. Give me the Andes on an overloaded bike any day. But the book came out last summer, and the paperback's coming out later this month. So that's exciting. So I've been going to lots of different festivals, book festivals, mountain festivals, green festivals, all sorts of venues, sort of using the book as a platform to talk about the ideas in the book about biodiversity, about why it's so important, about why we need system change, about what we can all do. So that's the current project. And Woody always comes if at all possible, and is always the star of the show. So going forwards, there's a bit more of that to come. And then I'm thinking about doing a UK life cycle. So getting back on Woody and cycling first in Cumbria, where I live, and then probably Scotland, where I used to live, and looking at biodiversity problems and solutions on the ground in different parts of the UK, and maybe making a short film about that.
Brilliant. That sounds amazing, and we'll be cheering you on all every step of the way, really.
Thank you.
That's absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Kate, for sharing your incredible journey and your insights with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. You just want to tell us, for those listening, the name of the book and where people can find it?
Oh, thank you. That's really kind. Yes, it's called The Life Cycle. 8,000 Miles in the Andes by Bamboo Bike. It's published by Icon Books. It's currently out in hardback. It's also in e-format and in Audible. And I'm actually the reader on the Audible book, which was another adventure. And it's coming out in paperback very soon. You can get it at all good bookshops, at Amazon, online. You can get it anywhere, basically.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.